My name is Susan Halver. I'm 46 years old. Today is the 29th of December, 2016. We are at Providence, Alaska Medical Center, and James is my friend. I am his manager, and we are both chaplains together.
My name is James Terry. I'm 34 years old. It's the 29th of December, 2016. We're at Providence, Alaska Medical Center, and Susan is my coworker and friend and manager.
So, James, I'm super excited to talk to you. We had a staff retreat a couple weeks ago, and you talked about your role in starting the Tranny Roadshow. And so I would love to hear more about that. So if you could just start by talking about what the Tranny Roadshow is and how it got started.
Yeah, so when the Tranny Roadshow got started, we didn't know what it would be. So those feel like two very different questions. The sort of tagline that we used, I think throughout, was that the Tranny Roadshow was a multimedia performance art extravaganza with an all-transgender cast. And we made that line up, I think, before we'd ever had a show. We weren't sure if it was going to fit or not. Like, multimedia, what does that include? Uh-huh. So I think I'll back up to where it started before what it became. So this was in 2004.
Okay.
And I was 22. And I think youth is crucial to this story because there was some naivete that came with that was helpful. And I was living in rural Maine for the winter doing a house painting job. I knew absolutely nobody in town except for the person I was working for. So I had, and it was Maine and it was the winter and you could barely leave your house, mm-hmm. and there was nothing at all to do. So I had all this time to sort of imagine what I wanted to do next. And I decided that what I wanted to do next was go on tour. And that was a very nebulous concept at the time. I had never been on tour.
Had you done performance stuff before?
Not much. I grew up playing violin, so I had done recitals. Mm-hmm. You know, I had done theater in high school. I had done things like that. I had done some poetry open mics, but I had never really been a performer as such. Certainly not the kind who goes on tour by themselves. But I had some friends who'd gone on tour, and it seemed fun. So I was like, I want to do that. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure what I would do on tour or where I would go or who I would do it with, but it seemed like a good idea. So I declared that I was going to do it. And then I had to think, what did that mean? I thought, well, I don't want to do it by myself. All those hours in the car, and I mean, I love road trips by myself, but it seemed different somehow. I wanted somebody to be in this with me. So I called my friend Kelly. Kelly Costello, but his sort of performance name is Kelly Short and Queer. And we had traveled together and lived together before, and so I knew that we could be in a car for a month and be okay. Mm-hmm. We had also done projects before. We'd started the Denver Zine Library together, and so I knew that we worked well together. And I called up and said, hey, do you want to go on tour with me? And he's sort of like, what would that mean? Well, I don't know, but we can figure it out. And we were both writers and zinesters, and I thought if nothing else, it could be a zine reading tour. Like, we had friends who'd done that seemed viable. Mm-hmm. But then we thought, wouldn't it be more interesting if it was more than just zine reading? Could we get somebody else involved who did something different? And three people seemed sort of ideal. You can fit in a car comfortably, somebody can lay down in the back. Like, we'll aim for three people. How do we find a third person? We had nobody in mind. Like, well, we should think of a theme and then look for somebody who fits that theme. Like, what's our theme? And well, I'm trans, you're trans, let's have a trans theme. And that was really all the thinking that went into that.
Uh-huh.
So we drafted an email, just a paragraph or two, about this show that we had imagined and what it could be, and sent it to our friends and said, forward to your friends. And this is before Facebook, that there wasn't sort of social media spreading. It was all by email forwards. And we just, we'll send this out and see what happens. And within a week, we had gotten back more than 100 replies.
Wow.
And that included people who wanted to perform, people who wanted to book the show, people who wanted to make our flyers, people who said, I own a restaurant. If you come to my town, I'll give you a meal while you're here.
Wow.
People who wanted us to stay in their house. It was just all these people saying, this needs to happen. How can we help make it happen? And it was this really powerful moment of, there's something going on here that's way bigger than us.
Yeah.
This is no longer about, me and Kelly and our desire to go on tour for fun. Mm-hmm. This is about the world has a need, and we've just been called to fill it. So this need for trans performance art, mm-hmm. and for specifically for trans performance art that got out of the big cities. It wasn't just in New York or San Francisco, but that was going into the middle of America and reaching people where they are and building community and, like, okay, we need to step up. So the original vision was something very different than what the show eventually became. And so we ended up with far more people involved in this grander vision that we were able to live up to. And that was pretty amazing.
That is amazing. So you got the idea in 2004. Was it 2004 when it happened? Or
So we started planning in late 2004, and the first tour was in the spring of 2005.
Okay.
And that first tour was 2 months straight. And this was part of the never having toured and being young and naive thing where, like, we had no idea that it was crazy to perform every night for 2 months.
Oh, geez.
So we thought we could do it, and then we did.
Wow. And you survived.
Yeah. It was not quite every night. We did 47 shows in 63 days.
Oh, my gosh.
And that included, I forget, 30-something states and a couple Canadian provinces. And we just went everywhere we could go nonstop.
Wow.
In the following years, our tours were never quite that long again. It was a good learning experience for how to do it differently the next time.
So say more about that first show.
The very first show?
Well, the first show or the first tour? Although that makes me curious about the first show.
So the first show was kind of an interesting anomaly. We performed all over the place in terms of venues. We did, you know, colleges and bars and churches and community centers and coffee shops and occasionally, you know, festivals or conferences or sort of other events that we were fit into, warehouses. And we did all kinds of things. The first year we did some house shows as well, though we ruled those out after the first year. But in general, we tended to have sort of medium-sized audiences, like, you know, 60 to 100 people might have been sort of average. And there were ones that were smaller, ones that were bigger, but that was sort of a standard.
Nice.
Our first show ever was as part of a conference that we were booked as part of the entertainment for, and there were like 2,000 people there.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was sort of an intimidating beginning.
Wow.
Like, okay, we're going to see. This is sink or swim. And it was fantastic, but it was a funny way to begin this tour where, you know, there'd be shows where we had 12 people, but our first show was 2,000.
Wow. How many of you were there performing in that first show?
In that first show, there were three of us.
Okay.
So the way the first year was structured, Kelly and I did the entire tour beginning to end, and other people came on and off for parts of it because most people couldn't take off 2 months of their life.
Yeah.
And we also were hesitant to take people on for 2 months that we had never met before.
Right.
And so we had other people who did as much as a month each, but more often it would be a couple weeks, or that people sort of joined for a segment and then... so there were shows that had lots of people and shows that had only a few people, and it sort of varied. And that was another thing that we learned was sort of about building more consistency in so that even if maybe you have one performer leave and another one begin, the number stays about the same throughout a tour.
Yeah. So what kind of performances did you have in that first tour?
Oh, gosh, we had so many different things. And part of our vision really from the beginning was to have it be, so it was in a variety show format, and we really wanted there to be variety. So throughout both the first tour and the years that followed, every show included some kinds of spoken word performance, every show included some kind of music, and every show included something else, and the something else varied. And sometimes there were many something else's, but that there was, people would do excerpts from plays, we had dance, we had a juggler 1 year, we had a puppeteer who toured with us several times. We had a magician, straight up stage magic. We had a professional opera singer who toured with us once. I mean, just a wide range of what kinds of things. I mean, even the music. Yeah, you know, there was sort of the folk and rock and kinds of things that you might expect, and hip hop. But then also there were things like classical violin and opera, and it was just all over the spectrum of what kinds of performance there might be. And every show was different.
Yeah, I would believe that.
And we also screened short films sometimes, so filmmakers could send work on tour with us. We also always brought physical art, you know, paintings or drawings or sculpture, like that kind of thing, photography. So we'd have artists who'd send work on tour with us, even if they weren't personally touring. So even when there were only a few of us, there were always more people represented than the people in the room.
How many tours have there been?
So we toured from 2005 through 2012.
Okay.
I don't know how many
yeah.
separate tours there were in that. The first couple of years we did, you know, one big tour, like the, you know, the 2 month tour in 2005
right.
and a 1 month tour in 2006. But then I think starting in 2007 that the model shifted to where we did shorter ones, but more often.
Okay.
So there might be, you know, a week here and a 3 day weekend here. And
okay.
you sort of go into a region and do three or four shows around and then go home
okay.
and go to a different region later in the year.
Yeah.
So it was, there were more in number, but probably less shows cumulatively in those later years.
So I'm curious about both if there are individual shows that stand out in your mind, and I'm also curious about some of the places that you went.
Individual shows that stand out in my mind, probably the ones that stand out are the ones where things went wrong in some way, because that's what
yeah.
comes up, which was not the majority of them, right?
Uh-huh. But, which is good.
yes. Yeah. One that comes immediately to mind, it was the first night of the 2006 tour. So this was, you know, we'd had our first year, we'd learned all kinds of lessons about how to do this more effectively and more professionally, I guess. And and we'd pulled together this amazing cast, none of whom had met each other until that day. I mean,
wow.
our
yeah.
model, because it was a variety show, you didn't have to rehearse together.
Right.
So everybody had up to 15 minutes. We asked for 12 to 15 minutes for an act. And we auditioned and all of that, often, you know, virtually by video or phone or something. And then the first time people actually saw each other's acts live was on the first performance.
Wow.
We would just hit a stage and do it. And there was always this, like, is it going to work this time? Like, you're never
yeah.
quite sure it's
right.
going to gel.
Right.
And it always did, which was amazing.
Yeah.
So it was the first night of that tour. We're all basically strangers. There were eight of us. And we were at a college somewhere in upstate New York. I can't even think what college it was now. And at college shows, typically there's some student group that hosts, and there's a student who introduces it often and gets
okay.
up and, you know, thanks their sponsors and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so we're sort of standing together at the back, and I'm getting ready to go up and MC as soon as the student has introduced the show. Or maybe I wasn't, I forget. Kelly and I took turns MCing
yeah.
the shows. And but we're, so we're standing together sort of nervously, like, waiting to see what happens. And this girl goes up, and she's, you know, saying how great it is that we're there and how they're so happy to have us. And then she says, you know, I mean, where else can you get, like, eight transvestites in one place?
Oh, geez.
And all of us at the back sort of, like, our jaws dropped. It was like, and now we have to go on stage. and you have all these performers who don't really know us yet, don't have a reason to trust us yet.
Uh-huh.
And we need to go up and salvage this for them before they get on stage. And
so what did you do?
So it's funny. I can't remember which one of us was talking because it feels like it was my experience either way somehow. So we went up and, you know, thanked her graciously for the introduction and also took the moment to do some education about sort of what words to use in a way that, trying to be really carefully, like, non-shaming of her
right.
because she was trying to say the right thing and truly didn't know.
Sure, yeah.
But also to be like, here's who we actually are.
Yeah.
And it worked, and it became sort of a running joke through the whole rest of the tour for that cast, and probably a moment that none of us will forget because
yeah.
it was so
yeah.
like, what do we do now?
Yeah, and even still, I think there's a lot of people that don't get the difference between transvestite and transgender.
Yeah,
so.
You usually don't have those people introduce a show.
That, but you would hope that that would be true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, that was one that stuck out. Forget the other half of your question.
So places, because I know you talked when we talked before about, like, going to places in the South and places where people traveled miles to see you.
Yeah. So we did. We were really intentional about sort of getting beyond the big cities.
Mm-hmm.
And we would generally do those cities, partly because you made more money on those shows, and that
right.
sustained the rest of the tour.
Right.
Because if you do a show for, you know, 20 people in rural Ohio, you're not going to make money on that show.
Right.
You have
yeah.
to sustain.
Yeah.
So we're really intentional about balancing those things. One that really sticks with me, I think it was the first year. We went to, it was definitely Alabama. I want to say Huntingdon, but that could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fairly small town in Alabama, which made all of us nervous, just in concept even. This is 2005, when trans visibility was significantly less than it is now,
right.
And not that it would necessarily be safe now either.
Right.
And one of the performers had a friend who lived there who was able to get us a venue, and they begged us to come. And they're asking us to come. We're not going to say no.
Yeah.
And it was like a converted warehouse sort of artist space. And I think we had 20 people. I mean, it was a small show, but everybody who was there needed it so desperately. Mm. And everybody was so effusive in their thanks for coming and couldn't believe that we had come there.
Yeah.
And they took such good care of us. And it was just really, really moving. These people who had never seen a trans person on stage being sort of authentic and public. And you have deeply closeted people who come to see somebody like them not being afraid to be like them.
Yeah.
And it was just, it was so powerful.
Yeah. And I think I'm remembering when you talked that people just did the stuff that they loved and were good at. I mean, it's not like every performance was about being trans. It was just people.
Yeah. And that was something I think that often surprised audiences, because they'd come expecting something that was more like educational almost.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so part of our sort of founding philosophy was that our art is inseparable from who we are, that art is created out of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so because we were trans people, it was trans art, whether it mentioned anything about gender or not.
Right.
And inevitably, in every show, there were some pieces that focused explicitly on gender and others that didn't. And we didn't dictate that. It always happened that way, that some did and some didn't.
Yeah.
And it really worked. I mean, like when our opera singer was doing her opera, it was not about being trans. This was classical opera.
Yeah.
But she was doing it as a trans woman. And that in itself was meaningful because she was, as far as we knew, the only trans opera singer out there, at least openly. So.
Yeah.
And so having those things where... Part of it was, we did have goals around education, but it wasn't like workshop style education.
Right.
It was like, we want to expand the vision of what it means to be trans. Mm-hmm. We want you to walk away realizing that trans people are multifaceted and that we can be all of these different things and that we are not reducible to our gender. And we were also really wanted people to see the diversity of the trans community And again, there wasn't as much trans visibility then, even for other trans people. Mm-hmm. And there was often this sort of idea of what a trans person is or looks like or can be or can do. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to make sure that we had people, of different races and different gender identities and different ages. We had performers from their teens through their 70s.
Wow. That's fantastic.
And have people who were parents and who were not and who were partnered and who were not. And who had different kinds of careers in their non-performing lives, and to really show this broad vision of what it means to be trans, which was partly to say, you can't reduce us to any one thing because look at how different we all are,
right?
And that the diversity of the cast of the show was almost as important as anything we did on stage, just the fact that we showed up looking the way we did.
Yeah. That's so fantastic.
Yeah.
I love that you did that.
Yeah. And that was a lesson learned from the first year when not all of the shows were as diverse.
Uh-huh.
Because of that model, people hopping on and hopping off for different parts.
Yeah.
If you looked at the total cast for the entire first tour, it was a very diverse cast.
Mm-hmm.
But any one show wasn't necessarily.
Right.
And that was something that we just didn't think through ahead of time well enough. And we were really intentional about every time after that.
And that's hard. I mean, it's because I think that we tend to know people that are like us. And so that's fantastic. I mean, it takes a lot of work to... really bring in a diverse group of people. So, yeah. Other places that you went that stood out for you?
Going into Canada was always tricky because crossing the border with a bunch of trans people whose IDs don't necessarily match their presentation. That was always nerve-wracking and sometimes smooth and sometimes not. We were definitely pulled over for questioning at the border multiple times. And once, I think it was the first time we went to Canada, Kelly and I were both given these documents that said that if we didn't leave the country within 48 hours, we were subject to arrest. And we had to check in on our way out to prove that we'd left.
Wow.
So that was interesting.
Yeah, that would be stressful.
Yes. But we had a show that night. We had to go to it.
Yeah.
And in Montreal, that was another his show that sticks out in my memory. And I don't know what sort of the cultural difference is that produced mm-hmm. this effect, mm-hmm. but it was, there were a handful of us, it was that first year when the cast tended to be smaller and, mm-hmm. and in some ways less diverse. And the show at that particular time was very funny. Like almost every mm-hmm. act was humor of some sort. Okay. And we were used to audiences laughing and, mm-hmm. you know, some lines work with some audiences and not others, but there were lines that always worked for everybody. Like there were moments where you knew right. the audience was going to laugh.
Yeah.
And we got up in front of that audience in Montreal and they were all completely deadpan.
Wow.
And nobody had any affect of any kind that we could see.
Wow.
And they didn't laugh at anything.
Oh.
And the first act finished and we're like, what do we do now? Like, do we keep going? Uh-huh. Are we allowed to just walk away? And we were all sort of taking turns going up, and every single one of us got this completely flat reception. And we're just like, they hate us. This is the worst show we've ever done. And it ended. And then they're all coming up to us saying, that was so great. We, you know, we loved it. Thanks for coming. They were buying our merchandise. They were like,
oh,
there was
so
this totally enthusiastic reception
yeah.
afterwards.
Yeah.
It's like, were those the same people? Like, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
And so we dreaded going to Montreal the next year, but we went again.
How was it the second time you went?
The second time, it was different. Mm-hmm. It was challenging in other ways. And I think after that, we never went back to Montreal again. two was enough.
The heck with Montreal.
Yeah. The second time we went, we were in this venue that was sort of more of a punk performance space.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some... What they said that they thought there were rats that had died under the floorboard somewhere.
Ooh.
And there was this terrible, terrible smell in the space that somehow nobody seemed to mind but us, which was also weird. Mm-hmm. Like the audience sat through the whole show just fine, but all of us, whenever we were off stage, went outside until it was our turn again because we couldn't stand to be in there. So, yeah, Montreal is not my favorite place.
Yeah, I've never been there, huh? So you mentioned before that it felt like your show was life-saving for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you've talked about that a little bit, but can you say more about that, or is there any particular story that comes to mind?
I think that was probably true for people in the audience at times, and then people said things like that to us
mm-hmm.
sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But where it feels most sort of true and certain to me is with many of the performers.
Okay.
So we had, over the years, more than 100 performers involved in the show.
Wow.
And some of them did it over and over year after year, and some of them mm-hmm. did one tour, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So different sort of levels of engagement, but lots of people. And it was truly life-changing in pretty dramatic ways for a lot of people. And I think of one performer, Red Durkin, who was in the first tour for a month. She was, our longest performer the first year and came back every year thereafter.
Okay.
And is still one of my closest friends.
Yeah.
And so she had never met another trans person
wow.
before joining our cast.
Wow.
She was just beginning to come out in the South and was sort of looking around on the internet, such as it was in
mm-hmm.
2004,
right.
For other trans people. And we didn't know this at the time, but we learned later that when she sort of looked mm-hmm. up, you know, trying to find anything about transgender people on the internet, she found two things. She found a support group in a city not too far from her
mm-hmm.
that she read about and decided was not for her at all based mm-hmm. on who it was meant for.
Mm-hmm.
And she found us. And so she sent off an email saying she wanted to be in the show. Now, she had also never performed. She had no performance background whatsoever. and she was just beginning to come out as trans and had never uh-huh. met another trans person. And she
wow.
was just like, take me on your show.
Wow.
And our performance screening process was almost non-existent the first year. That also changed after that. So she didn't have to do a real audition. We exchanged some emails. She seemed like somebody that we could be around. She
mm-hmm.
seemed smart and funny, and we weren't clear what she was going to be doing exactly, but
uh-huh.
we hoped that she was clear on it. She turned out not to be either. we took the chance.
Yeah.
And the only photograph she sent us was a super close-up that showed, like, I think one eye and her nose. You couldn't really see what she looked like.
Oh, interesting.
Her name was Red, which was totally androgynous.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't know what gender she was, and she
yeah.
intentionally used a bio that included no gender
yeah.
for the website. Like, she gave us
uh-huh.
no clues about who she was
yeah.
or what she was going to do, and we
yeah.
just took this chance. She turned out to be absolutely brilliant, and watching her style
mm-hmm.
come together was over the course of touring
mm-hmm.
as she experimented mm-hmm. with different things, and
yeah.
she ended up sort of finding her niche as a stand-up comedian,
okay.
but tried a lot of things along the way.
Yeah.
And and has become probably one of the better known trans performers, particularly in like the YouTube world, mm-hmm. In more recent years. But for her, you know, again, she'd never met another trans person. She was desperately searching some reflection of herself in the world. Yeah. We also learned later that she didn't even know that trans men existed, like that was a thing, until we showed up at her door.
Uh-huh.
And she knew that some trans people were coming, and she saw us and was like, huh. Okay.
Wow.
And, you know, she didn't tell us that until later. But
yeah. Yeah.
So, and she has said, you know, and through that, she found her community. She found sort of her calling, her, you know, place in the world. And she, at the end of the tour, she moved. She never went back to that town. So she used the tour partly as a way of scoping out the rest of the country and finding where she wanted to be.
Nice.
So learning, you know, who she was and where she wanted to be and what she wanted to do there and all of that through this process of touring with this group of people. Mm-hmm. And she has said many times that without the Tranny Roadshow, she'd be dead. That she like has no doubt that that is what kept her alive. Yeah. And I've heard similar stories from other people who were in the show who, you know, however they first connected with it, it came at the right time, at the right moment, and gave them something they hadn't found anywhere else. Mm. And I think in a lot of ways that was true for me too.
Yeah.
That I didn't feel like I had a community until I built my own. Mm-hmm. And that was how I did it. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I had somewhat similarly to Red, although I had the advantage of living in D.C. when I came out, so I had more access. But so I'd met other people, but like I tried going to a support group once and was like, oh, these are not my people, you know, that particular group anyway.
Yeah.
And I had sort of tried some things, and I had a trans roommate for a couple months that worked out really badly. And so it was like, I knew some trans people, but they weren't reflecting me.
Yeah.
I didn't have a community that felt my own. And so built this show, right?
Yeah.
And discovered in that my community, it couldn't be as specific, or I mean, as sort of broad as trans people, because again, that can be all kinds of different people.
Right.
But that my community was trans artists, and specifically traveling trans artists.
Yeah.
When you combined all of those things together, I loved every single person I ever toured with. And a lot of them, we were very different in lots of ways, but we had at least those three things in common, and that was enough.
Yeah. So, how are you different because of that experience? Or how has it shaped you?
Oh, in so many ways. I think one thing is the confidence it gave me in sort of making things possible. In that, you know, again, so going back to the beginning story where we had this grand vision, but no idea how we were going to do it.
Yeah.
And we just believed that we could.
Yeah.
And I really think that part of that was youth and ignorance, because if we had known at the beginning of the tour what we knew after it, we would never have tried.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, we had friends who were in bands who'd done tours, like, you're crazy. Like, oh, no, it'll be fine. but having done that and done it successfully and done it repeatedly, I am more confident in general in sort of trying the grand ideas and thinking, like, I can have an idea and make it real. I've done it before.
Yeah.
So that's one piece. I feel much more connected, both in specific and in broad ways. I mean, I feel connected to this sort of national network of people, many of whom I'm not still in touch with and don't necessarily have names for, including like audience members and you know, venues and hosts and that sort of thing, where I have, knowing that I have felt deeply connected to thousands of people all over the place in these really intense moments, gives me this continued sense of connection sort of to the world. And in more specific ways to the people that I toured with, most of my closest friends are people that I met touring. And they are the people who I know will always be there, that like we have been through these experiences together that were often beautiful and often really hard. And we've seen each other through all kinds of things and been incredibly vulnerable together.
Yeah.
And like, those are my people. That's never going to change.
Right.
So it really did give me my community. And I think the other piece is that it also is probably in some ways directly responsible for me being here as a chaplain. Like, my sense of calling came out of that experience.
I'm so glad you say that, because that was going to be my next question. Well, because I love that, I mean, we're both chaplains, and I love that you really heard this as a call. I mean, you know, you had the idea and then discovered the need for it. So yeah, I was curious how, you know, you've been a children's hospital chaplain now for a year. And so how has that gotten you here?
So it's probably less directly responsible for me being a chaplain than for mm-hmm. me being in ministry at all. Mm-hmm. But my sense of call to ministry came really pretty directly from the show. And so what that looked like for me is I was raised in church. Religion was always a really important part of my life. When I left home, unlike a lot of my peers, I did not leave church. I mm-hmm. continued finding churches in the communities that I went to as a young adult and was often the only young adult showing up. Mm-hmm. So religion and faith had always been important to me personally. And part of what I found in building trans community was how incredibly rare that was. That not that people didn't have faith or have deep spiritualities or have yearnings, mm-hmm. but they didn't have any connection or community related to those yearnings.
Absolutely.
And I heard so many stories of deep hurt from people who mm-hmm. had been rejected from their churches or religious communities, or who expected rejection and so left preemptively, mm-hmm. or had been so rejected by their families based on faith that they weren't willing to try again.
Right.
And we had performers who identified as Christian and Jewish and Buddhist and all of these different mm-hmm. sort of religious identities that would sort of come up in their sense of who they were. Mm-hmm. That weren't connected to practice or community.
Yeah.
And more specifically than that, through the show itself, and it took me several years to notice this, but what mm-hmm. I started realizing was that almost every performance, like truly almost everyone, invoked religion in some way. But it was never head on. That nobody, mm-hmm. if you asked them, thought they were talking about religion, uh-huh. but it was in the stories from their past, or it was in the metaphors in their music, or it was in the imagery in their art, or it was just constant things of religion like lurking in the corners and in mm-hmm. the background, mm-hmm. but never being allowed to come into the fore. Mm-hmm. And that just really struck me as like, this is something that has shaped us as trans people specifically, that we aren't willing to talk about.
Yeah.
And I was consistently the only person who talked about religion in any direct way. Mm-hmm. And I'd have people after the shows come up and talk to me about that a lot. That was often what struck a chord for audience members of, sort of their own relationships with the church or their family or religion at large. Mm-hmm. And just really not having a language to talk about that or a space to talk about that. Mm-hmm. I think, and I've heard many people talk about how in sort of the gay community or the queer community, mm-hmm. there's often sort of taboo about even mentioning religion.
Yeah.
Gene Robinson tells a story about a time when he was speaking at an event, I think it was an HRC event, mm-hmm. and he asked people in the room, how many of you go to church? And half of them raised their hands. Mm-hmm. And then he asked, how many of you have ever talked about it here in this space? And every single hand went down. And just that idea that, like, this is something that's important to us, but we're afraid to talk about it in this other part of our community that's also important to us.
Right.
And so I just saw that there was this silence in churches about trans community mm-hmm. and silence in trans community about religion.
Yeah.
And that all of those wounds that I was seeing and hearing mm-hmm. were never going to be healed until that silence was broken
right.
on both sides.
And it's still super hard. I mean, there are mm-hmm. very few spaces where I feel like I can be authentically all the pieces of who I am.
And absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it became clear to me that I didn't know necessarily what that meant or mm-hmm. what it was I needed to do. Mm-hmm. But I needed to do something, that there was this gap yeah. between the church and the trans community, and that my call was to be in that gap
yeah.
and to try to be a bridge builder, beginning at both ends as somebody mm-hmm. who had a foot in each world,
yeah.
And to try to make space for the rest of us. And so that sense of need and calling came out of my experience in the roadshow mm-hmm. and led me into seminary to try to figure out, I don't know how to do this, but I know I have to do this, and here's where I begin.
Yeah.
And through that process, I ended up here eventually.
Yeah.
But that I don't think I would have ended up in ministry if it hadn't been for the roadshow.
Mm-hmm. So can you say more about what it means for you to stand in that gap? Like, how do you see yourself in that place with feet in two worlds?
That's a hard question to answer. And the answer has probably changed lots of times,
yeah.
even just in the last several years. Sometimes the work is really sort of explicit and obvious. You know, I've gone into churches and done sermons about welcoming trans people into the community, and I've done workshops and sort of teaching for churches and for religious professionals, and done some sort of didactic work in that way. But I've also done a lot of sort of showing up and holding space, and sort of like in the roadshow, where part of the point was to let people see us as multifaceted people and as, you know, a diverse community and as who we are rather than as a stereotype. And that still feels like part of the work on both sides. To be, you know, a witness in trans community that religion isn't only this oppressive, harmful, hurtful thing, that it can be that, that is absolutely real. That it can also be something else, and that I know because I've seen that. To share my positive experiences so that people know that that's possible, that if they want a way back to the church that they left, the way is there. They don't have to take it. I'm not an evangelist, but I'm just, I want them to see that the way is there. And to sort of have a hand that reaches out for people who want to take it.
And I think for me, standing in that gap has led to me standing in a lot of other gaps. I think as a chaplain, we just keep finding the gaps, and we hold the space for people to be whoever they are and feel loved and that God's presence.
Yeah. I think, and I'm just thinking about this now, but I think it probably is one of the gifts that I bring to chaplaincy is that sense that not only my own faith, but my sense of ministry and calling all comes out of people who are disenfranchised from religion, which is a lot of what we see in the hospital, in Alaska in particular, and a lot of people who need a chaplain most, that people who are well-connected have good support already.
Exactly.
The people who are disconnected and disenfranchised and don't know where to turn but know that turning somewhere is important, they're the ones who need us most, and that is the people that I'm also most suited to care for.
I am so very glad to get to do this work with you, James, and to share this gap with you.
Thank you.
So, you're a good reminder to me that I'm not alone standing in this gap.
If I had to boil down what I learned from the roadshow and what I hope other people learn from it, is that we are not alone.
Well, thank you so much for taking this time today.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
So I realized I had one more question. So I didn't actually ask you what you did, like what your performance art was in the Tranny Roadshow.
So I did a lot of different things over the years. I did storytelling, and I did poetry, and I did music, and I did sort of more abstract performance arty things. But what I eventually realized was that all of it always was about narrative and storytelling, and that everything else I did was in service to that. I was always trying to tell a story. And always a true story, that it was about reflecting pieces of my life and trying to put out sort of positive queer and trans stories that I wasn't hearing anywhere else. And to do it in a way that was really specific to me, but also reflected things that felt bigger than me and universal and that people could sort of hook their own stories into.
Nice. And I love that, because I know, I think for me, for my own call to ministry, telling stories and hearing stories has always been really at the heart, I think, of what I'm called to, and it sounds like that's kind of true for you as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you for letting me ask that follow-up question.
Sure.